and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and that music means we're about to have a really good Friday afternoon. Thanks for being here with us on this Friday afternoon, or maybe Saturday morning, where you are. And that's the Weird Questions music. So Jimmy Akin is here for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Jimmy, of course, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, author of a whole bunch of books, including A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist, and the host of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, a very popular corner of the podcasting world. Jimmy, thanks for being here with us.
Hey, my pleasure, Cyril Kellett.
So that people send you weird questions.
They do. How about that?
Do you ask them or do they just send them out of the blue?
Some of both. Uh-huh. Sometimes I ask and sometimes they just send them.
Mm-hmm. And so we have collected a bunch of them up here to present to you. To get your answers to these weird questions. One of the reasons we don't do weird questions live is that when we did do weird questions live, the questions often weren't that weird.
Actually, I don't think we've ever done weird questions live.
Oh,
but
yeah.
There is a certain amount of filtering that takes place to make sure they're weird enough.
Yeah. And so don't ever feel that your question might be too weird. I don't think that has happened yet. And you can send it to us.
That has never happened.
You've never thought, no, that's just too weird. No, that's
No. My policy is answer every question as it comes in, regardless of its level of weirdness.
And people know that they can ask you just about anything too. So it's not just weird Bible questions or weird Catholic questions. They will ask you all kinds of weird things. Well, let's start with Logan. I loved your movie, Logan. Suppose a modern lay Catholic, baptized, confirmed, etc., were transported through time and space to the year 5 BC, Jerusalem. Assuming he or she retains his or her knowledge and beliefs from the 21st century AD and is aware that he or she has arrived in a time before the incarnation has taken place, in what way would this Catholic be obligated to worship God? Would he or she need to live as a Jew under the Mosaic law, given that the new covenant has not yet been established in their present timeline? Or would he or she be required to live according to Catholic practices to the best of their ability? Would he or she be morally obligated to be a sort of prophet proclaiming the coming Lord? Or perhaps be obligated not to, lest they affect salvation history?
So we got a bunch of questions there, and we'll take them one at a time. The first one is so 5 BC is like a couple years before Jesus was born, according to our best evidence. And so the new covenant would not be in effect yet, and if one were transported to this time, one would not be obligated to live as a Jew, unless one was of Jewish origin. But if you're a Gentile Christian and you're transported to before the time of Christ, you don't got to become a Jew because you never had to become a Jew. The Jewish people had a special covenant with God up to the time of Christ, and they still have a covenant with God today, but they were required to observe the Mosaic law up to the time of Christ. But other people were not. If you were a Gentile, you were not expected to get circumcised or keep kosher or anything like that. That was part of the Jewish covenant. But as a Gentile, you weren't obligated to do those things. So unless you were of Jewish origin, no, you wouldn't be obligated to live as a Jew. Instead, you would be obligated to live in another category. There was a category of Gentiles who did not become Jews, but who nevertheless worshiped God, the God of Israel. And they were known as God-fearers because they had reverence or fear for God. And so you would be obliged to live as a God-fearer. In other words, as a God-fearing Gentile. You would not be obligated to keep specifically Christian commandments like worshiping on Sunday because that had not yet been instituted. So you wouldn't have to do that. You would not be authorized to conduct Christian sacraments like Christian baptism because that has not yet been instituted. And you would not be obligated to be as a prophet, and proclaim Jesus, but you also perhaps would not be forbidden to discuss Jesus. I mean, you could say, hey, unless something else intervened, like a particular circumstance, I don't see why you couldn't say, yeah, I'm from the future and you should watch that Jesus of Nazareth guy that's about to be born. He's going to be the Messiah. I don't see a problem with saying that, but I don't think you would be obligated to tell people that either.
Oh, all right. Would you be permitted to maybe send a letter to Marty McFly that he would get in the year
1955?
Yeah.
I don't think the papyrus would survive that long.
Yeah, probably not. Tell him who's going to win the World Series in 1960.
I wouldn't know how to do that. I'm not into sports ball.
Yeah, I don't know who won the World Series in 1960 either. Probably some St. Louis fan or something going, how can you not know?
But I do know who won the World Cup in 1966.
Really? Now, yeah. Why would you have that odd bit of knowledge?
Well, it was the British, and they beat the Germans, and the reason I know that is because it was in a Doctor Who story.
Oh. All right. Logan, thank you very, very much for the question, if you're still with us, if you haven't time-traveled already. Tim has this question, Jimmy. I'm curious about whether Satan can bless people or things. By bless, I mean supernaturally enhance in the manner requested by those seeking the blessing.
Well, at least reportedly, yes. And fundamentally, I'd say the answer is yes, because that's the devil has an angelic nature, and angels can do, you know, positive things for people. So the devil has the same fundamental capabilities as an angel. So the devil would be able to do positive things for people. He might do them for his own reasons and so forth, but he would have the ability to do them. And reportedly, that's what happens in various cases where people make pacts with the devil in exchange for, you know, goods and services the devil could provide them, like make them famous or wealthy or something like that. However, you don't want to make that kind of a deal because it comes with too heavy of a price. You shouldn't be making deals with the devil, and therefore it can kind of be a mortal sin. So you don't want to do that.
No making deals with the devil, Tim. Thanks for the question. That brings us right up to the time for the first break. So you need to get over to shop.catholic.com right now and take advantage of the store-wide sale at shop.catholic.com. Can you tell I'm reading this? We've got hundreds of items on sale: books, online courses, candles, puzzles, scapulars, clothing, and so much more. You can even load up on all your favorite Jimmy Akin books and School of Apologetics courses at great prices right now. What are you waiting for? Okay, he wrote this, so I have to read it. Skedaddle over to shop.catholic.com. He wrote skedaddle over to shop.catholic.com. And let the savings begin.
It's not like he asked you to say absquatulate over.
No, that's true. Or what's the one about throwing people out the window? Defenestrate. He didn't tell me to defenestrate over.
Yeah, that wouldn't make sense. But skedaddle and absquatulate do.
Carrie, why are you making me say skedaddle? All right, I want to say it again, though. Skedaddle over to shop.catholic.com and let the savings begin.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hey, this is Michael O'Neill, the Miracle Hunter. I'll be delving into the fascinating world of miracles and taking you on a hunt that explores the greatest mysteries and marvels of the Catholic Church. I'll be examining what constitutes a miracle, how miracles are investigated and approved, and the role they play in the lives of the faithful. We'll look at the miracles of the Gospels and early Christianity, considering the claims of the miraculous in our own modern age.
The Miracle Hunter, Saturday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. That music means it's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. spending our break while you're listening to ads trying to explain who Deion Sanders is to Jimmy Akin. What sport is this? Yes, it was football. He is a football player.
Well, I asked what they were talking about. You know, he became a sports commentator, and they were going, oh, yeah, I didn't even know he was a sports commentator. And I said, what was he before? And they said he was a wide receiver, and he was a something else. And it would have done to just say he was a football player.
Yes. All right. Jimmy's like, that's football? Yes, you guessed correctly. I am impressed, however, that you knew the World Cup winner of the 1966 World Cup.
Yeah, that was the first time Britain actually won it.
What? Now you know two facts about it. Holy smokes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also know it was not actually invaded by the Daleks.
Oh, well, I see. No, there's a fact I did not. There's an interesting sports fact that I was not aware of, that the Daleks did not invade the 1966 World Cup. I'll have to go back and look at the replay on that one. It's weird questions. People send their weird questions. People call, ask Jimmy weird questions. They write him letters. They send him weird questions. Some of that, I'm sure, has increased since you started doing Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. What dropped this morning, by the way, on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Patrons' questions. So every quarter, we answer questions from our patrons on Patreon, many of whom ask weird questions, although they ask others as well. And so this is a release of an episode we did a few months ago. It's a general release, answering patrons' questions. One of which involves the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but is different than a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle question we have coming up for today's show.
Oh, so two Ninja Turtle questions covered by Jimmy Akin in one day.
In 1 week, yeah. Or one day, since this release is Friday.
Yeah. Elias asks this. If someone is trapped in a time loop, like in Groundhog Day or Edge of Tomorrow, is it still a sin to commit suicide in order to reset the time loop? If you already have been trapped for several weeks, then it would probably feel annoying to wait out the entire loop if you mess something up. And then he concludes with, thank you for all your amazing work, Mr. Akin.
Well, thank you so much, Elias. So I thought about this carefully, and the way the question is structured, what it presupposes is you're in a time loop, and if you die in the time loop begins again, but you do not lose your memory. So it's not. So it's like in Groundhog Day, where Bill Murray remembers every loop.
Right.
It's not like in the Doctor Who episode Heaven Sent, where he's in a time loop and he gets killed at the end of the loop, and the loop begins again with him having no knowledge of what's preceded. Oh. So we have a situation where your consciousness continues in embodied form. It's just you've jumped back to a previous stage in the scenario. And given that, I would say it doesn't look like you're actually committing suicide. You're not actually dying. What happens when you commit suicide is your physical life ends and your soul goes on to the afterlife. Mm-hmm. But that's not what's happening here. You aren't ending your physical life. Your soul is not going on to the afterlife. You're just hitting a reset button. So your biological life continues from an earlier point or at an earlier stage of the scenario, and your mental life continues on as it was at the end of the current loop.
Right.
So you're just jumping back in time. So if this is correct, then it looks to me like you're not committing suicide here. You're just jumping back in the time loop by performing an action that looks like suicide, but actually isn't. And if it isn't suicide, then it's not obviously a sin. And so I would say doing things that look like suicide but aren't in this scenario, I don't see it being obviously a sin.
Elias, I hope that was helpful to you. That is an excellent sort of time travel suicide question. I'm not sure where to categorize it, but it's a good one.
Well, it involves time travel for sure. Does not appear to involve actual suicide.
Right. This one comes from Tabitha, and we have arrived at the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle question. Mm-hmm. I write Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles fan fiction, mostly action adventure stories. I am currently outlining a story where the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles meet a Catholic apologist. I have modeled her after Mr. Aiken in both personality and intellect. Nicely done, Tabitha. I like this so far.
Although it's a little weird for me thinking about a female Catholic apologist modeled off me and modeled off me in personality and intellect, but not physical appearance, I guess.
No, but I think writers do that sometimes to give it I don't want to make it so Jimmy Aiken that it's just obviously Jimmy Aiken. So they switch
it up. That's fine. And good luck with your fan fiction.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see what her long red beard looks like.
not physical appearance.
Oh, okay. In my story, the apologist is explaining the Catholic idea of the soul to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. One of the things that has hung me up a little is that I believe all sensitive and rational souls are created immediately upon conception. The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles started out as ordinary turtles, so they were given sensitive souls the moment they were created, before they were even born. However, now that they have mutated, they have rational souls. One of the characters questions whether the turtles' sensitive animal souls died and a new rational soul was installed in them when they mutated, or if their souls were changed when they mutated. Initially, I had the idea that God upgraded their sensitive souls to rational souls upon their mutation, but a friend of mine suggested that maybe they were conceived with rational souls, but as it took 15 years for them to develop from babies to teenagers, they simply didn't express their rational souls until they were old enough, mutated enough to talk. I'm curious as to what Mr. Aiken would say and would be grateful for his perspective.
Okay, so it's an interesting question. I remember when Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles first started coming out. I remember the first comic books that they appeared in, but I never really read them, so I don't have a firm grasp on exactly when in their life they became mutated, whether they were mutated as babies or later. Also, I would mention there's not a single Catholic view on the soul. There's actually a bunch of options. And although it is, you know, the standard way of classifying souls to talk about vegetative souls that plants have and sensitive souls that animals have and rational souls that humans have, those are a traditional way of looking at it, but they're not official Catholic doctrine. So, what could we say in this situation? Well, I can't exclude the idea that someone proposed that God gave them double souls at the beginning, so that they may have had both a rational and a sensitive soul. And I can't exclude, and God could maintain that dual soul miraculously somehow. Mm-hmm. Or I think this is actually what the other person proposed, was that they were given rational souls in anticipation of their later mutation, and it just took time for the rationality to manifest. Just like it takes time for rationality to manifest in humans.
Yeah.
You know, we're born with rational souls, but we're not rational from the moment of birth. That takes time to manifest. I couldn't exclude, since God is omniscient and omnipotent, I mean, God knew they were going to mutate, and being omnipotent, he could have given them rational souls from their conception, but I don't see that as being the most likely alternative. I would tend to go with Tabitha's initial thought, which is that when the mutation happened, they got a soul upgrade. That's the way it seems to be presented in the story. They become more human-like. They have more human-like minds after the point of mutation. And so I would say, well, okay, God changed their souls just like their bodies were changed by the mutation. I wouldn't say they died, because if their souls had gone out of existence, why would that happen? Their bodies didn't go out of existence. Mm-hmm. You know, they have physical continuity with who they were before. And so I would say they have spiritual continuity with who they were before. It's just they've got upgraded souls now. So, and if you wonder, well, how could God transform a non-rational soul into a rational one? Well, he does transubstantiate bread into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of his son. I mean, transubstantiation, changing one substance into another, is clearly possible for God. So he could transform or transubstantiate a non-rational soul into a rational soul. If he can turn bread into divinity, well, then he can turn a non-rational soul into a rational one. So I don't see a problem there. And that would appear to be what happens based on the story. I would note one other thing, though, since this apologist is supposed to be modeled after Jimmy Akin. Jimmy Akin has looked at the arguments that have traditionally been made concerning whether you need a rational soul to survive death. I did that. I want to say it's in episode 203 of Mysterious World on Animal Afterlife. But I looked at the classical arguments that have been made to argue that you need a rational soul to survive death, and I just don't think they're persuasive. In fact, I think we've actually got evidence that at least some animals who would have sensitive and non-rational souls do in fact survive death. And you can listen to that episode of Mysterious World if you want to hear what that evidence is. But so if I were talking to the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and they were asking me about the whole sensitive rational soul thing, I would point out, before you were mutated, you did have sensitive souls that weren't yet rational, but that doesn't mean you wouldn't have survived death.
Thank you, Tabitha, for that question. That definitely fits the weird questions category. That was a good one and an excellent opportunity to kind of reflect on souls. This one comes from Ellen. Actually, these come from Ellen. She says, I have a few questions for you.
Okay.
And we'll start with her first question. If angels are spiritual, eternal beings existing outside of time, how can they be created in time if eternity is outside of it?
Yeah, it would be a paradox, wouldn't it? And here's the answer. Angels are not outside of time. That's not the kind of eternity they have. The term eternity gets used in two senses. In the formal sense, it does mean outside of time, and God is eternal in that sense. God is outside of time. But God alone is eternal in that sense. Everybody else is inside of time. And so the term eternal also gets applied in another way, which just means everlasting. So Cy Kellett, for example, is an eternal being in the sense that he's going to last forever. Like it or not, he's going to be around forever.
Like it.
And I didn't prejudice the answer there. I said, okay, you got an option.
All right, well, I did.
You know, I didn't tell you which option to choose.
Okay.
Cy and I and you and angels are all eternal beings in the informal sense that we're going to go on forever. But we, unlike God, are inside of time. And so angels are created inside of time and continue to exist inside of time, and they don't go outside of time.
Ellen, thank you for that one. All right, we'll go to Ellen's second question now. She says, when we die, our souls survive our mortal bodies. Mm-hmm. If our souls are eternal, how can we be created in time if eternity is outside of it?
Yeah. Second verse, same as the first.
Yeah.
We are eternal only in the sense that we go on forever. So we are created in time, we exist in time, and we go on forever in time. We are not outside of time the way God is.
Okay. And then Ellen's final question. This is a good one. I hope Jimmy can answer this. How did God create something out of nothing? If it is against the nature of nothing to be something.
So the question presupposes that nothing has a nature, and I would challenge that. I would say it doesn't seem to me that nothing has a nature. It would seem nothing is the absolute lack of a nature, and therefore it wouldn't be contrary to nothing's nature for something to come from it. Having said that, you're going to need divine power to make that happen. When we say that God made the world out of nothing, we shouldn't think of nothing as if it was a substance that God reshaped in order to fashion things. We should think of it as the absence of anything. There's no substance there. Then God, by his power, produced space and time and matter without making it from any prior substance. And that's what we mean when we say he made the world out of nothing. We mean that there was nothing that preceded the world that he used to create the space and the time and the matter that he did create.
Ah, Alan, what excellent questions. Thank you very, very much. And I hadn't thought about that someone might think of making something out of nothing would make nothing into some sort of substance that you had to form into nothing. And it's really hard to think about nothing.
Mm-hmm. It is.
Yeah.
If people undertake extensive training with meditation to try to think of nothing, and it doesn't work too well because our minds are programmed to change subjects about every 3 seconds.
Oh, really?
For survival benefit, so we don't get eaten by a leopard because we're paying too close attention to something else. So our minds wander and inevitably think about something.
I cannot think about nothing because of leopards. We will take a quick break. Be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live. When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Is relativism dead? It sure seems dead. Each day, new moral demands are made and they are presented to us as absolutes. Everything from transgender ideology to physician-assisted suicide is presented as a moral good that all right-thinking people must accept. But Catholic Answers' own Carlo Broussard says look deeper, and you will see today's moralism is just relativism dressed up in new clothes. Carlo's eye-opening book, The New Relativism, shines a light on how the sacred moral teachings of this age cover up a deep denial of moral truth. Order your copy of The New Relativism today at shop.catholic.com and be prepared to defend the truth against aggressive relativism. The New Relativism at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I really like the music. I have said this too many times, probably. I really like the music for Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And I have to consciously say it in my mind before I say it out loud, Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin, because I always want to say, welcome back to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And that is not correct. That's a different thing. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, you can find at mysterious.fm or wherever you listen to podcasts. But this is Weird Questions for Jimmy Akin. Go ahead.
Yeah, although these Weird Question shows do eventually appear on Mysterious World. So
right, right. Oh,
I am here and you are here and we are all together, goo-goo-goo-joob.
Thank you, Jimmy. Thank you. And sometime we're going to need what is the meaning of goo-goo-goo-joob for Jimmy for Weird Questions. Not today, but we'll get to that. Mike's got a question.
No, right today you just wanted to know in the break, when did the word ass become associated with a part of the human body?
Well, because for a long, long time, the animal has been called an ass. You actually looked it up and told us that it was transferred to representing part of the human anatomy in 1860.
Well, it's attested by nautical slang in 1860. There are some precedents going back to the 1600s where it was arse, but we have the modern usage by 1860.
And like a lot of things in English, we have two words, ass and donkey. I wonder if one of them is Latinate and one of them is Germanic. Donkey sounds kind of Germanic to me. I don't know. I've always wanted a donkey. You could have a donkey where you live. Really?
You don't want a donkey.
I just always thought it'd be
They are stubborn and hostile.
They are?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember once I was driving in the desert southwest, and I drove up to this ghost town, and they had a pen of donkeys there. And as soon as I get out of the car, the donkeys are like making their, you know, their kind of whinny sounds to try to intimidate me.
Really?
You know, I just get out of the car. And
it's like a donkey
there's gang. Like hostile, you know, donkeys there being hostile to me.
Well, I just always thought it would be the greatest thing to ride around a Southern California beach town on your donkey. I think, like, I don't know why. I think that'd be awesome. But I actually looked into it, and you can't have, I'm not zoned for donkeys or goats.
I was reading a book about atomic accidents once.
Of course you were.
and it's kind of like a dark comedy because every chapter, you know, you start and you know the story is going to go bad.
Yeah, right, right.
It's just a question of how is it going to go bad.
Yeah.
But the nuclear engineer who was writing the book was commenting at one point about a nuclear reactor is like a donkey. It will do tons of great work for you, but remember, it secretly wants to kill you.
I never knew this about donkeys, that they were so
donkeys and their mule offspring. That's why we have the adjective muley to mean stubborn.
Oh yeah, yeah. And you, Edgar, I'm going to ask you this: do you know the difference between a donkey and a burro? It's just the Spanish word for donkey. Come on, man! I thought you would know that. All right, this is Mike's question.
And burritos are little donkeys.
Yes, they are. I don't know why a burrito is called a little donkey, but do you know, Edgar? No? No. All right, but they are delicious. Mike has this question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. And for some reason, we got off track and started talking about donkeys, which is one of my favorite subjects. I do love donkeys, but I didn't know that they were mean. What is Burning Man really about? Mike wants to know. It seems to get a lot of media attention each year. My stepdaughter and her husband have both apostatized from the church and went a few years back. They have regional burns as well. Burns like they burn something regionally as well that they attend. The stories they seem happy to tell people seem very disturbing, almost satanic, certainly evil. Nothing at all like what I get from Mr. Google or the media. Who is the Burning Man? Do you have any insights on any of this?
So Burning Man is a counterculture festival or event that is kind of best described as an excuse to have a party in the desert. That's really what it is. It involves the creation of art and music in the desert for people who attend. It includes some transgressive elements, such as drug use, and in the past, it's also included some casual nudity, although that's decreased markedly in recent years because cell phones.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. There, from what I've been able to determine, there appears to be no particular symbolism to the effigy of the man that gets burned on the next to last day. I mean, they call him the man, but he doesn't seem to represent anything in particular. And they do different versions of the man from year to year, and then they burn it on the next to last day just as a way of giving the event a notable anarchic climax. So it's kind of like it's got some of the anarchic spirit of, like, you know, rock bands that like to smash their guitars and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's just a kind of transgressive, minorly transgressive, destructive element as a kind of, you know, juvenilia bacchanalia.
Nice combination, juvenilia bacchanalia. Mike, thank you very much for the question. This one comes from Michael. I have a weird question, I think. I know in the early 20th or late 19th century, Catholic theologians mentioned the desirability to baptize not yet born babies in the womb mm-hmm. as long as it was safe and possible. My question is, why isn't this done right now, even without medical intervention? It seems to me that the form, I now baptize, the matter, water, after all the baby is submerged, is something like salt water, intent and minister can all be present to administer the sacrament.
Okay, so yeah, there have been statements from the Holy Office, which is now called the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith. But in the early 20th century, you did have a statement from the Holy Office asking if it was possible to add disinfectant to water in order to baptize a baby before birth. And the answer was, yeah, you can do that. In terms of the scenario that that Michael envisions, he seems to want to baptize the baby without a medical intervention, just in its own amniotic fluid, which it's already surrounded in. The problem with that is amniotic fluid is not suitable matter for baptism. It is not natural water. In order to perform baptism, you need natural water, and it doesn't have to be pure. I mean, it can have, you know, if it can be spring water or something, or it could be muddy spring water, or, you know, from a pond or something like that. So it doesn't have to be pure, but it does have to be natural water. And even though amniotic fluid is very similar to water, water being its principal component, it's not the same thing as natural water. Just like Diet Coke. You know, its principal component is water. It is overwhelmingly water, but it is not natural water. And so as a result, you can't baptize someone with Diet Coke, and you can't baptize someone with amniotic fluid. You need to use regular water for that, preferably, though not essentially, water that has been blessed. And you need to bring that water into contact with the baby, either, which is going to mean you're going to need to either do a cesarean section. So you're going to need to surgically open up the mother's womb in order to baptize the baby. Or you could hypothetically use amniocentesis. Now, they didn't have, which is where you use a needle. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't have amniocentesis back in the 1930s, which is when I believe this ruling from the Holy Office came. At that time, the only option was cesarean section. But today, you could use ultrasound and stick a needle in, attached to a syringe that's filled with holy water, and then squirt the holy water on the baby's head, which you could see in the ultrasound. So you could do it that way. That would be kind of the minimally invasive way of doing it. But either way you go, there's going to be some risk of infection. And it's still difficult to do it this way. So a lot of people haven't really jumped on this. I wouldn't be surprised it's still being done in cases of medical urgency in some places. But it's a difficult procedure that involves some risks. And also there's a greater awareness today of the possibility of God providing salvation for a baby that dies without baptism, you know, in other ways besides just baptism. I mean, you know, the catechism says that we may entrust such children to the mercy of God. And so because there's a greater awareness that God has other ways of providing salvation for these children, getting them baptized before they're even born is not as pressing an urgency because they're not in the same kind of danger. I do, though, have an idea for a science fiction story or even universe that I may write about someday, where in the future it's normal for people to be baptized before their birth.
Oh, all right. So, you know, Jimmy, this is of interest to me because we had a question we didn't know how to answer the other day. I forget who the guest was about. They do surgeries on babies now and then put them back in the womb. Yep. And so under your way of thinking about it, then you could baptize that baby while it was outside the womb.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's helpful. Because that baby, if it's having surgery, is actually probably in danger of death as well. And, yeah, okay. Michael, thank you for the question. That brings us to the break. We'll take a quick break. Be right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and his gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Are you having trouble in your marriage and don't know where to turn? Has your spouse stopped going to Mass with you? Has infidelity taken place in your marriage? Have money issues put your relationship on a bumpy road? Do you have issues with your in-laws? Hi, I'm Janet Williams. Join me and my husband, Jack Williams. We talk about marriage and how we are to lead our spouse to the faith. It's Marriage Monday on Women of Grace, Monday at 11 a.m. Eastern on EWTN.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Thanks for being here with us on this Friday afternoon.
It's always my pleasure. And this time during the break, you were talking about birria, but you weren't pronouncing it right. It's birria. It's got an are, not just an R in it.
Go ahead, Edgar. Edgar wants to birria.
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 Yeah.
Oh, birria. And I didn't pronounce it. I didn't roll my R.
You got to trill the R there.
Well,
which is a kind of stew.
And I was, the reason I was talking about it, because Edgar and Joe Heschmeyer love birria. And mm-hmm. They go to Mr. Birria down the street here. Well, I saw that Del Taco, it's not quite Taco Bell, but it's
not quite Spanish either. It means of the taco.
No, they now have birria on their menu. And I'm going to get you some, Edgar, and you're going to try it. And you're going to tell me if that's authentic Mexican food that they're serving at Del Taco, which, as Jimmy pointed out, means of the taco. So this should be high quality Mexican food. Anyway, I apologize for mispronouncing birria. You know, on NPR, they never mispronounce Spanish words. Bob asked this. It's a weird question for Jimmy Akin. Oh, my God. If a priest travels at the speed of light, does he still have mass?
Okay, so this can be answered in two ways. In the first way, now obviously Bob is punning with us here, but to answer the question straight, because I always answer questions straight, if a priest travels at the speed of light, then he would still have mass because it's going to be very hard to get a priest up to the speed of light because it requires progressively more and more energy to make a massive object go faster. And the more mass something has, the more energy you need in order to accelerate it. So in order to accelerate a priest to the speed of light, you would need to have infinite energy. But you know who's got infinite energy, Cy Kellett?
Only God.
Yeah, God does. So God could accelerate a priest to the speed of light, and he would still have mass in that case. He would still be a massive object. But then there's the second way you can ask the question, which is, would he still be able to celebrate Mass? Well, if he was moving at the speed of light and exposed to the vacuum of space, if he was accelerated to the speed of light, then he would probably die in that process because he would be exposed to not only to the vacuum of space, but also to massive amounts of radiation because every photon that he encountered would smack into him with tremendous force. It's like if you're walking down the street and you just happen to bump into a wall, you know, you may bruise your nose, but it's not going to kill you. Whereas if you're riding a motorcycle down the street and you bump into a wall because of your velocity, the wall's going to hit you as if it was moving at that velocity. And in the same way, if a priest is accelerating up to the speed of light, then all the particles he's going to encounter, including photons, are going to hit him with effectively tremendous force, raising their energy level. It would be bad. So he'd probably die. But if God was going to accelerate a priest to the speed of light,
if he's going to go that far,
he'd probably protect him.
Yeah.
So God could protect him from the effects of accelerating to the speed of light. He could even just snap his fingers and have the priest going the speed of light so there wouldn't be an acceleration. But here there's another issue, which is as you approach the speed of light, time slows down. And when you hit the speed of light, time stops. So every photon that's traveling in the universe right now, like all the photons that are lighting up the Catholic Answers studio, they are not experiencing time. they travel from the perspective of a photon. Mm-hmm. They travel from the beginning of their journey to the end of their journey without any time passing at all. It's instantaneous from their perspective.
Wow.
And so if a priest were traveling at the speed of light, time would not be progressing for him, and he would not be able to celebrate Mass because it requires the progression of time to be able to perform the ceremonies.
Wow. I am so glad you asked that question. You know, the world is really weird, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some, you don't often, well, maybe you do, but like, just to think about that, the photon could travel across the entire galaxy, and the photon itself doesn't experience it.
But if a photon traveled across the Milky Way galaxy, from our perspective, it would take it 200,000 years.
Yeah. Weird. Bob, thanks for the question. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin. Carlos asks this: could it be possible that we prayed for something in our past to be different, so maybe God answered our prayer and changed the past event, and we are no longer aware of it because it is like it never happened?
Okay, so I have an episode of Mysterious World where I talk about praying for the past. And in that, I say, yeah, actually, we can pray for the past, but I don't recommend praying for things we know didn't happen. Like, I couldn't pray that the Twin Towers never fell on 9/11, because I know it was God's will to allow that to happen. However, Carlos is proposing a different scenario where we can pray for things in the past and God can change what happened in the past. And he's asking, would that explain why we're no longer aware of it, because it no longer happened in our timeline? Well, we could have multiple timelines. Now, I don't know that we do, but mm-hmm. we could have them. And if I pray in one timeline that an event in my history be different than it was, then that God could do something with the timelines. He would be doing this from, it'd all be simultaneous from his perspective in eternity, but he could allow a separate timeline to branch off at a point in the past. Let's say, just to keep the stakes small, let's say last night I ordered pizza for dinner. And I could, maybe I get food poisoning from the pizza, and I pray to God, please change the past so that instead of ordering pizza, I ordered Italian. Oh, well, pizza is Italian. Chinese.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
I ordered Chinese.
All right.
And, well, God could have a timeline branch off from last night where I ordered Chinese instead of pizza. And so in that timeline, I would not remember ordering pizza, because in that timeline, I did not order pizza. Mm-hmm. So that would accomplish the effect Carlos is talking about, at least from the perspective of me in the Chinese dinner timeline. But the pizza timeline still exists, and I will never experience the me in the pizza timeline will never go back and experience the Chinese dinner timeline. Because I'm living in the pizza timeline. So I could pray for the past, and we could have a branching timeline where this happens, and I wouldn't remember the change, but I'm locked into this timeline where history played out the way it did, and I can't change the history of this timeline. Now, you could propose something weirder, because there is an idea in physics that's sometimes called the sum over histories. This is related to the work of a 20th century physicist named Richard Feynman, a 20th century physicist and bongo player. And and one of the things that he proposed is that you can conceptualize the present moment in history as being a sum of all of the possible histories that could lead up to this moment.
Okay.
So if like you have a particle located right here, wherever here is, you can imagine it being located right here as the result of summing up all of the possible histories with all of the possible trajectories that particle could have taken to get here. And so the idea is, just like there are many possible futures from the current moment, there could be many possible pasts leading up to the current moment. And it's possible that you could integrate Carlos's, now there's a question, is that physically real? That sum over history's idea.
Right.
It is not clear that that is physically real as opposed to a convenient mathematical trick for performing certain equations. But if it were physically real that the universe has multiple histories leading up to the present moment, then something like Carlos's proposal might be something you could integrate with that, but I'm not sure how it would work. My knowledge of that area of physics is not extensive enough.
All right. Well, we'll say thank you very much for the question. Appreciate it. I'm going to keep going because we got a few minutes left, and I think we can get at least one more in. This one comes from Bob. Did God give us incisors because he knew that one day we would eat meat, even though he originally forbade it prior to the flood?
Okay, so if you read Genesis, God doesn't actually forbid eating meat prior to the flood. He just didn't give explicit permission to eat meat. He gave Adam permission to eat all the plants, the garden, all except for one. And then after, so he makes Adam the gardener of Eden, and he lets him eat the fruit of the garden. And then after Noah becomes the zookeeper of the world, so he cares for all the animal life, Noah's family gets the right to eat animals. But that doesn't mean that nobody ate animals before the flood. Now, so it's not that God prohibited eating meat before the flood. He just hadn't given permission for it. But that wouldn't mean it never happened, even if you take early Genesis extremely literally. But then there's the fact that we actually shouldn't take early Genesis overly literally. It conveys uh-huh. truths, but as the Catechism says, it does so using symbolic language. And in the language of Pope Pius XII, when he addressed the first 11 chapters of Genesis, he says they use simple and metaphorical language to convey these truths. So what we're dealing with here is simple metaphorical language. So what truths might these two bestowals of food communicate?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'll notice they both involve work. Adam is working as the gardener of Eden. He's the caretaker of these trees, so he gets to eat the fruit of the trees. Adam is working as the world zookeeper. He's caring for the animals, so he gets to eat of the animals. And so it looks like the fundamental message here from the two grantings of food is that people have a right to enjoy the fruits of their labor. So if you work to care for something, whether it's plants or animals, you get to make your living from that. You get to physically live mm-hmm. From the fruits of your labors. And so it seems to me that's the real message that's being communicated here. It's not that we should look to this as if it's a literal historical account of prior to a certain time, humans didn't get to eat meat, because if our ancestors had not eaten meat, we probably wouldn't have incisors, because that's what incisors are for.
Oh, God. All right. Thank you very much. You want to try another one?
Sure.
Before we go? All right. Adrian says this, why haven't we been back to the moon despite the advanced technology?
I think there are a few reasons. One of them is lack of perceived short-term return on investment. Now, it's been argued that when we did the initial moonshot, we actually made money on that. We developed technologies that improved our economy. But that's a kind of a long-term benefit that isn't obvious. And it hasn't been obvious to people, especially in Congress, that we would benefit by going back to the moon in the short term. They're thinking in terms of what would it cost to get there. And they haven't seen a compelling reason to go back until recently because we didn't have a Cold War space race underway. That's the reason we went to the moon in the first place, was to beat the Russians there. So now that we have other countries like China interested in space exploration and the moon, guess what? We're being re-stimulated to go back to the moon and other places. Also, it's not all encumbered by the government now. We have private initiatives working along the same lines.
I'm not going, but you all have fun out there on the moon. Jimmy, another hour coming up, right? Do another hour?
Yeah.
All right, we got another hour of weird questions. We've got lots of weird questions to come. Jimmy Akin is our guest. Don't forget, you can get Jimmy Akin's books on sale right now over at shop.catholic.com. Don't just go over there. Skedaddle over to shop.catholic.com and get your books. Right back with more weird questions for Jimmy Akin right after this. on Catholic Answers Live.